Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, July 7th, 2007. I'm Harley Schlanger and I'll be your host today. There are moments in history when the pace of events seem painfully slow, when change seems to be but a distant dream. In those times, the majority is lulled into inaction, succumbs to pessimism, and tolerates even the worst injustices. We've been living through such a period much of the last decade, arguably even longer. Fortunately, throughout history, there have always been individuals who have rejected the zeitgeist of such periods, who never gave up hope that positive change can be forthcoming, and who mobilized a cadre force to act even as the rest of the population seemed indifferent to the degeneration of the society around them. And then, as the society is suddenly confronted by a crisis, one which has actually been building over years and has occurred because of the failure of that generation to address the underlying problems which have been developing, there is a brief moment when change becomes possible. It is at those brief moments that events seem to take place at a pace which is breathtaking. At such moments, leaders emerge not on the basis of popularity, but because they have offered solutions based on great ideas, which only yesterday were rejected, even scorned as impractical. But suddenly, these ideas represent unique solutions which alone offer society an opportunity to escape an otherwise inevitable descent into depressions, wars, and dark ages. We are now at such a moment, which Lyndon LaRouche has characterized as a brief moment of opportunity, during which nations may act to reverse the effects of decades of indifference to the horrible direction that their society has taken. In particular, we've reached the moment when mankind can no longer progress or even survive unless decisions are made which will end the global reign of a system properly called the Anglo-Dutch Empire. Today on the LaRouche Show, we'll review this confluence of events which has put us in a position to defeat the Anglo-Dutch Empire, which has been the dominant force in world politics since 1763. And we will discuss the process by which you, the listener, can join with Lyndon LaRouche and the LaRouche Youth Movement in this historic battle to restore the American system, which is the only known antidote to the disease of Anglo-Dutch liberalism, and not only in the United States, but worldwide. Our guest today is historian Jerry Rose. We will also have a panel of leaders of the LaRouche Youth Movement, including Michael Kirsch, who's presently involved in the special project on Gauss's discovery of the orbit of Ceres, and Mihwa Steger, who will be joining us from Los Angeles. Jerry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Harley.
So let's begin with the significant transformation of recent days with the Bush-Putin summit, and the growing likelihood that Vice President Cheney can be induced to resign or be impeached. As is often the case, as I indicated in the introduction, this transformation has been built by developments over years, but let's begin with the most recent period. What's behind this shift, and specifically, what has Lyndon LaRouche set in motion, which has helped precipitate this shift?
Well, I think the most dramatic point of transformation occurred on the 21st and the webcast that Lynn gave, in which a whole set of developments leading into then to that point was totally transformed by Lynn's intervention, as we call it, an intervention with heavy ideas. Because, as you've been pointing out, Harley, you've come to the end of the Anglo-Dutch liberal system, that nothing on this planet could possibly save this system. It's over. It's finished. The only question that mankind has to face is what will replace it. You could have chaos in a dark age, or you could return to the very American system, which came out of the as a reaction to the wild looting and destruction of the American colonies by this Anglo-Dutch liberal system. That, in fact, America was founded as a profound philosophical, moral, political, and economic reaction to what was set in motion by the 1688 takeover of England by William of Orange, who was Dutch. That's why it's called the Anglo-Dutch liberal system. And therefore, what we're looking at is those your choices are that the Anglo-Dutch liberal system has collapsed. And Lynn intervened on the 21st to provide an impulse tendency, which obviously was picked up on some level by Clinton, former President Bill Clinton, was picked up on a different level and in a different way by Putin, President Putin of Russia. And since dynamics are what they are, a very strange set of people around H.W. Bush, the Bush Sr., which includes Kissinger and some other people, were drawn in by a set of proposals by which you could avoid a total collapse of the system. In other words, you'd have to introduce a new set of axiomatic principles based upon the American system, which in fact should not surprise anybody, because the Anglo-Dutch liberal system actually provoked, because of its failures, its unbelievable failures, provoked in our founding fathers and a new set of axioms based upon, as Lynn identified in that talk on the 21st, the idea of man is not an ape, is not an animal. And therefore, those are the choices that we have. But a new set of principles that Lynn introduced, has been introducing, but that on the 21st, he presented in a way with such force and such clarity that what was developing up until that point, people realized they had to act. And now you have, as Lynn said this morning, in a brief statement, you have a crisis of ungovernability. And under those circumstances, even Bush Jr., the actual Pres W, who is the putative president of the United States, is could grasp for certain other arrangements, which is what we're seeing now.
Well, Jerry, let's, for the sake of the listeners who may not be totally updated on this, let's just hit a couple of the key points.
Sure.
Going back to following the June 21st webcast, which, by the way, will be out in a DVD within days. And I want our listeners to take down the number to call to order copies of that. That's 800-929-7566. So that's going to be available in DVD form very soon. But what Lynn set in motion in that then got picked up with the strangely named Lobster Summit, with the revision or the bringing the SDI back on the table. What can you tell us about that?
Well, sure. What we know is that a whole different set of processes were set in motion to pull off the Kennebunkport or Lobster Summit. We know that at Yeltsin's funeral, both H.W. Bush, W.'s father, and Bill Clinton met with President Putin. And at that discussions with H.W. Bush, it was proposed that Putin come to Kennebunkport and discuss strategic relations. And so therefore the whole process was not Cheney. Cheney was not invited to Kennebunkport. And had Cheney not been severely weakened by the cumulative effect of our work and others, then this summit would have never occurred, because Cheney would have said, don't go. And Bush would not have gone. Remember, he was in Prague several weeks before, about a month ago, in which he was at some crazy confrontational conference which included Sharansky and some others, who were calling for a strategic confrontation with Russia.
In fact, the discussion in much of the media, ill-founded as it was that we were headed toward possibly a new Cold War or something even more serious.
Right. And then you see, given the BAE scandal, which you got through last week, and other things, Cheney has been weakened to the point that W not only showed up to the summit, but was prepared to discuss certain different strategic orientation toward Russia. And in that context, before that meeting, Bill Clinton had proposed that there be no strategic conflict with Russia, that there would be a joint deployment of anti-ballistic missile defense systems jointly deployed by the United States and Russia. And then we find out today, or yesterday, that a whole set of arrangements around the peaceful development of nuclear energy explicitly for the developing sector was initialed at that meeting. So that you have a strategic tilt to an absolutely, totally different orientation, reflecting Lin's idea of these four power arrangements, where Russia, China, India, the United States could tell the Anglo-Dutch liberal system, you're finished.
And this is war avoidance on the higher level. On the one hand, the joint deployment of the Strategic Defense Initiative would put a brake on possible nuclear confrontation. But then beyond that is the return to a whole set of ideas around global infrastructure development, energy development, which is this four-power arrangement.
And the only thing, you got to think about this. This is in the context of LaRouche's visit to Moscow himself for Menshikov's birthday. And previously, LaRouche delivered a paper to the Russian Academy of Sciences on the question of the Bering Straits tunnel. So there's a whole set of arrangements and dynamics which are taking off at this point, which indicate there is the potential for a total strategic shift.
Now, Jerry, when a lot of people think about this situation, we see a growing sentiment toward the impeachment, desire for impeachment of Cheney, a recognition that this has been a completely failed administration. Why is it that Lin insists on characterizing the enemy at this point as being the Anglo-Dutch Empire?
Well, because, and this is a very important point, which people should realize why this BAE scandal is the scandal that it is. And not just scandal, but it's the core of the enemy power. Because, you see, the Anglo-Dutch liberal system recognizes no nation state. In fact, the very existence of the Anglo-Dutch liberal system is based upon using nation states as tools for looting, or using nations as tools for looting and governments as tools for looting, right? That one of the incredible ironies of history is that in 1688, the Dutch king, William of Orange, was asked by the Whigs of England to come to England and take it over and become the King of England. So it was a Dutch king asked to come to England to become the English king by the Whigs. And Mary was the daughter of James II, so she had some claim to the throne. In fact, she should have been made queen. I mean, by any standard, she should have been made queen. But James was alive. James II was alive, so he was gotten rid of. Right, he went to France. What came to power in England at that point? Why did they hate the monarchy so much? Not because the monarchy was bad, and they were bad. I mean, monarchies are bad forms of government, but they weren't bad enough that the king would still have the power to oppose, if he so pleased, the Venetian financial establishment that had taken over England, which is a much longer story. So what they did was they dumped James II, who they did not control, although he was crazy. You don't get any good guys unless you go to America. There's no good guys in this fight, right? But there were worse guys, right? And they dumped James II, get a Dutch king to run England. And then he commits England to a war with France. Marlborough, and this is, I must say, the more I study this period, the more a genius I think Graham Lowry is, right? The more you know about this period, you the more you are in awe of Graham Lowry's book on how the nation was won. But what you realize is that this war with France was used to set up the Bank of England. The Bank of England was set up to prosecute the war with France, to put the nation, what was left of England, into under receivership by the Bank of England to the tune of £6 million, which is an enormous amount of money for that time, at 6%. And they indebted every part of a landed part of England, the peasants, the landed aristocracy, everybody was indebted and taxed to pay the Bank of England. Who ran the Bank of England? The Whig grandees who invited William to the throne.
So it wasn't even the monarch who was sovereign under the system.
No. They tried to turn William into a doge, right? He didn't go for it. But by the time, and Queen Anne, which is a whole other story, which is a brilliant story that Graham tells, because she was totally written out of history. Queen Anne, working with Swift, Jonathan Swift, and the Tories, who opposed the Whigs, and Harley, who was the, you may be named after him, by the way.
Better than the motorcycle.
but Harley, Lord Harley, was working with Jonathan Swift to oppose the takeover of England by the moneyed interests, which were the Whigs. So the BAE scandal goes to the core of the thing, because what is the BAE, as John Holfoll points out in the most recent article in the EIR, this is the financial interest behind British Petroleum, Royal Dutch Shell. All of them were involved in this Yamama deal, right? And what does it represent but the slime mold power of the financial oligarchy, which has reigned in England since the time of William II. In other words, the Glorious Revolution, which everybody says the idiots who teach history, say somehow John Locke, who was a toady of Lord Shaftesbury, right, who created slavery in the United States. It was Shaftesbury and Locke that created slavery in the United States.
And they were operatives of the...
They were operatives of the Whigs who invited William into power. And William invaded. And Marlborough, who was very close to... who later was the great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather of Winston Churchill, right? But Marlborough, who was with James II, turned on James II... And he and his wife attempt to take over England to prosecute perpetual war. For who? As Jonathan Swift points out in one of the most powerful pamphlets ever written, called The Conduct of the Allies, he points out that Marlborough and the Whig grandees behind Marlborough were making 6% and more on stock in the Bank of England. And the reason that they didn't stop the war is because they were looting England through the war. and extending geopolitical power of England, right? So the BAE and the nexus, as John Hopeful goes through, quite interestingly, the nexus that the BAE represents is the financial slime mole, the Venetian financial slime mole that sits on England. The government of England is a subsidiary, as it was under the British East India Company, is a subsidiary of this financial slime mole.
And under current conditions, Dick Cheney has been an operative of this.
No, it's very directly, as Anton Chaykin points out in the article that he writes, that Baroness Simmons, who is the core of the Cheney, Lynn Cheney, who's much more important than Dick Cheney, as Lynn always goes through, they're directly involved in the BAE scandal, right? And what is it? It's the dirty black ops side of this financial oligarchy with tens of billions of dollars in slush funds. And as Lynn pointed out, and Lynn thought one of the most dramatic things he said and most important things he said was when he indicated that this grouping had the motive and the power to be behind 9/11.
You're listening to Jerry Rose on the LaRouche Show. We're going to bring in our LIM panelists in just a moment. For those who have questions, if you want to send us an email, you can send it to us at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. And we'll try to get to your email questions. But I think this is an extremely important topic, and we'll be getting to in a moment why it is that understanding this history is essential to being able to make the right decisions to act today. So, Jerry, just you've now identified the origins of the Anglo-Dutch Empire. Lynn has often pointed out that this empire became the dominant global power in 1763. What was it that then, I mean, this was, we just finished July 4th, which was the break with that.
Yes.
But just give us a sense of what happened in 1763 in terms of this consolidation of power.
Well, what happened was that there was a series of wars against Louis XIV, launched by William of Orange. I think the best description of these wars is, as I said, by Jonathan Swift in the famous Conduct of the Allies, right? But what happens in 1763 is that they finally defeat the French completely, and they sign a treaty with the French that the French would leave Canada, that the French would leave India, they would keep certain colonies, and that Britain became the dominant empire in the world at that point. They became unrivaled by the French in particular, and became the, using the British East India Company to run many of its colonies. Remember, it was the British East India Company tea that was dumped in the harbor in Boston in 1776.
So this was really the first modern, what you would call a globalized empire then, with the free trade, with the whole nine yards.
Exactly. In other words, there was oligarchical wars in Europe for a long time. And remember, the Venetians, who had the best diplomatic corps in the world, and they were evil beyond belief, but they were effective. They understood the weakness of every single court in Europe. Now, when they migrated, essentially and increasingly under James I into England, but I mean, they were doing it under Henry VIII, but they really consolidated under James I with Paolo Sarpi. England became their critical tool in constantly destabilizing Europe or using them as a tilt factor in Europe, right? But they also were manipulating the Spanish and the French against the English and the Dutch And the Austrians, the English, Dutch, Austrians played a role because of Luther and the whole split in Europe. So there was constant wars. I mean, you cannot think of Europe from 1511 onward, after the League of Cambrai, except one perpetual war after the other, one empire fight after the other.
So Cheney's policy of permanent war, as most cases with Cheney, is not an original idea with him.
No. Oh, no. This is Venetian. And even before then, it was Byzantium, but it's Venetian. In the most modern time, it's Venetian. To play one empire against another is Venetian. That's what the Venetians did, right? With intelligence and a certain amount of naval capability. Mm? But anyway, the point is that by 1763, the British had settled that fight with the French, and they became the dominant oligarchical power in all of Europe at that point.
And so the next break in history was really the one that led up to our Declaration of Independence in 1776, and the American Revolution against that Anglo-Dutch Empire.
It's an amazing story. I just, as I said, every time this is about the third time I've read Graham's book, and the more I read and the more I think about it, I am in awe of what he accomplished in that book. Mm-hmm. Because what he points out is there was a small break under Queen Anne. And why was there a break under Queen Anne? And, you know, I don't want to go, historical analogies are not always the most accurate things. But the fact is that Marlborough, the Whig grandee who invited William in, was prepared to launch a coup against Anne. Right? Queen Anne. Lord Harley of the Tory faction and Jonathan Swift, who worked with Lord Harley and Lord St. John, I forget his last name, but St. John. These two created a back channel to the Queen. And because Marlborough had overstepped his bounds and the war had been won, but they kept it going on. In 1709 at Blenheim, the war was won. It should have been ended at that point. And they kept the war going, and England was being bled dry. So Queen Anne revolted in 1710 when the Whig government was thrown out of power, and Anne turned to the Tories with Jonathan Swift as an alternative to this Whig policy. At that point, inside America, the lid was lifted, right? And two very famous governors, one Hunter of New York and one Spotswood of Virginia, were appointed by Queen Anne to develop the country and break beyond the Alleghenies, right, and into the Shenandoah, right? Because of that, and the impulse tendency that allowed, we were capable of fighting and ultimately winning the war against Britain.
Well, as we identified at the beginning, the question at that time for the American Revolution was to define an alternative system to this Anglo-Dutch Empire. I'd like to bring in Michael Kirsch at this point, who has done a significant amount of work on Alexander Hamilton and the actual establishment of the American system. Michael, summarize for us, what are the key essential differences between the American system and this Anglo-Dutch Empire?
I think the way that what Jerry just brought people through up to the lead-in into the situation that Hamilton found himself in is absolutely essential, because that, right, what he laid out actually defines the context in which it now is very, to me it appears very, it seems very apparent what Hamilton had to do, because, as he said, you have a globalized system, much like today, which is controlled by private banks who are putting nations into war with one another constantly. And essentially what we had in the United States, we were chained to relying on contributions by wealthy folks and private banks and other nations in order for our own country to work. And so what you had was, with Hamilton, is that he actually set up the capabilities, the different principles of organization that could turn a bunch of bankrupt states into a unified nation, which had a capability to move itself forward. Now, I would say people have to think for a second. They got to go back, as what Jerry laid out. You have a Europe that's in complete warfare. You have the United States, which is in the middle of a war against Britain. And you didn't have a unified country. You had George Washington, Hamilton, and others in the middle of this war having to work half the time to just get the states to send in funds. So you didn't have a nation as a whole that was fighting a revolutionary battle. You had the Declaration of Independence, which said that these states were sovereign, but it wasn't an independent. It wasn't a unified independent nation. So what you have with what Hamilton did in the middle of the war, 1781, was actually leave the assistance of General Washington as aide-de-camp to move to what he realized was going to be the bigger battle, which was taking on this, as was very clear now as Jerry laid out, was this embedded Venetian-style banking system that was really, even if we did eventually win the war, which we did 2 years after Hamilton left Washington's side, would still drive the United States into conflict amongst the states and inevitable dependency upon some sort of exterior banking system.
In fact, Michael, isn't that pretty much, despite the success of Hamilton and the victory with the Constitution and the initial proposals on the national bank, protectionism, tariffs, and so on, mm-hmm. hasn't that been the continued fight in the United States, that there's still been embedded elements that are tied to this Anglo-Dutch system?
Yes, that's the essential point that's going on right now, which is why I think it's very important the way that we've started off the discussion today on the question of the recent breakthrough at Kennebunkport with Putin and the push by Clinton and George Bush Sr. to move ahead with what Lyndon LaRouche has been pushing for since 1981 with his proposal of a nation-state cooperation in the world. Because this is the essential point that I think we're dealing with, which is that we will not, as a nation, be able to develop. We will not be able to get out of the crisis we're currently in unless you have within the sovereign lawmakers a rediscovery of what the concept of the nation is.
Now, Michael, that's where I want to go next, but let me just remind the listeners, this is the LaRouche Show. It's July 7th, 2007, and we're talking with Jerry Rose, Michael Kirsch, and Mihwa Steger about the potential now to end the Anglo-Dutch Empire and establish the American system of economics as a replacement system which can work on the basis of a community of principle among sovereign nation states. Now, you just said something interesting, Michael, and I'd like you to develop this a little bit for us, which is that you have to know the history from the inside. Now, you're doing some work right now, which is literally revolutionary work, on a couple of figures who are very poorly known in the United States, Abraham Kästner and Carl Friedrich Gauss, who were contemporaries of the American Revolution. In fact, Kästner knew Benjamin Franklin. But let me pose this question to you. Why is it necessary, from your standpoint, to know the inside of the work, the inside of the minds of the great scientific thinkers, such as Kepler, Leibniz, Kästner, Gauss? Why is that work necessary to be able to offer political economic solutions to our present crisis?
Well, let me take this up in two different pathways, because I think the first is to keep this at a point, I think, where people, listeners of the show especially, have been following so far. Why is it, as you ask, why is it necessary that you have to understand the development of and the communication of ideas through history? Well, just to start with an example, let's take this, what we've been discussing, the question of the U.S. Constitution, the question of the foundation of the American system of political economy. Well, right now the United States was founded and it has to be run by the fact that the United States is run by principles and not rules. And there's a big difference there, because rules can be put in a book and people can memorize the sentences that follow rule A, rule B, rule C, just as in science people can memorize formulas. But the United States was founded on the fact that principles have to be passed down each generation, have to be rediscovered each generation. The Constitution doesn't in fact work unless you have a Socratic discussion in the Congress to redefine every generation in which pathway the nation is going to go. Problem is, you get this kind of, you get this objection from people who say, well, but how can you have a nation be running on something that's guided by a discussion or an understanding of the Constitution as principles, because this requires the fact that the nation's going to be based on reason. And this is where this question of the necessary understanding of creativity comes in. Because the creativity is not a mysterious force that we can't understand. And having a nation that's based on Socratic dialogue amongst lawmakers rather than a set of rules, arbitrary rules, this is the foundational struggle here, which you have in what right now the LYM as a movement as a whole is investigating and discovering, is reliving through the process of the discoveries of Johannes Kepler. Right now we're now leading into the application of the principles that Kepler discovered in how Carl Gauss was able to determine the first asteroid series. And it's the same, it gets to the same question, because with Carl Gauss, you have a situation where he's faced with trying to determine an orbit for which he only has a very, very limited number of observations. And in fact, if you look at the amount of observations, 19 observations in 41 days, that amounts to essentially reducing what you know down to only the change, the time intervals. All you have is change, and it defines the issue that the change is what's primary. That is, it's in the small, the change, which is what defines the essence of things, not sense perception, which is the big problem in the way that people think about government, political economy as a whole. So what we have to do now in terms of rediscovering the nation and having a sense of the nation as a set of principles, it has to be, people have to sense that this, they've got to realize that this deep principle of a nation that was created by human discovery is not created by a set of rules. It's based on created laws that are embedded in the Constitution, but they were created by an ability to essentially understand that created by ability the authority essentially the authority of the human soul. So the point I'm getting at is that people say, well, we can't how can we follow a nation which is only run on how can we have a constitution which has to redefine itself every generation? But this is the difference that we have a human, nation versus a set of rules.
This is actually what we started with in the discussion, where I pointed out that many people can live a whole life without even thinking they have to concern themselves with these kinds of principles. But in a moment of breakdown like this, where the economy is collapsing, the infrastructure's gone, people are dying on whole parts of the planet, there's a commitment to permanent war from Cheney, and it's at a point like this that the population is called upon to think on a different level. And I'd like to bring Mihua in at this point to just give a sense, Mihua, from your organizing recently, are you beginning to see the potential for change in the population? What's it look like out there?
Well, the population, I'm assuming you're talking in general, not just youth, but in general?
Yeah.
Well, the climate in the population, essentially, I mean, it's gone through specific phases. Earlier on in the Bush, during the Bush presidency, the latest election, you had a pretty large amount of apathy and pessimism and somewhat rage coming from the population. And I've actually witnessed a real shift in the direction that the population is thinking, in a much more positive direction, in a much more optimistic direction. And just, you know, we've been able to organize around the idea that unless, you know, you plan to do something about the situation, then you really can't complain about it. And we've challenged, out on the deployments, we've challenged the population more on this question, that it's going to take a real commitment from the citizens of the nation in order to be able to change the direction that things are moving.
Well, let me throw another question at you. A lot of our supporters wonder, because they just heard Michael talking about principles and science. And, of course, when Lynn talks, he says the same principles that underlie discoveries in the physical universe are those of artistic creativity. And I know you've done extensive work on science with the Gauss Project. You're now working on Kepler. But you also are playing a role as one of the leaders of the choral movement that's an essential part of what Lynn is creating in the youth movement. How does that fit in? How does the choral work, the creation of a choral movement in the United States, why is that something that's necessary?
It's important because, I mean, look, we play a very important role as a movement right now, particularly because a majority of the people in the population have really been robbed of a sense of history. And I think what the most important thing that the work in the physical science and the music and the culture, the most important question that comes up is around the question of identity. And that it's not so much, you know, we just want to make all these breakthroughs in the science and the music and make everybody smart, but the work is not necessarily going to be of the greatest quality if that individual sense of history or sense of identity within history isn't developed. And so if you put it in the context that you're actually participating in something quite unique in that, you know, in this period of history where we're really close to impeaching Cheney. There's this Danish saying about having blood on the tooth, that this is where the population is. We almost have Cheney out, but we can't relent. We have to keep going. That the reason, you know, a lot of our contacts that come into our meetings and they get immersed in ideas, you know, with the chorus, from the chorus to a political briefing, to a strategic work through of Kepler, that at some point during the night, that contact is going to say, well, wait a minute, I thought we were just here for some political reason. And that's where you can really address the fact that it's a unit conception, that there's no difference between your historical identity and what you do with it in history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd like to add something to that as well.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think the issue of, well, what's this question about music and science, and aren't these different things? Well, I think one thing is that Lynn's been stressing as well, that the ability to act, to in fact act upon something you know to be true, means that you have to be willing to be human, fully human. You have to have a passion to say, look, this is not, I am not a computer who's programmed to act a certain way and play out a fantasy, which is really the big problem you have with most education and most people, including those in government today. There has to be not only an understanding of whether things are true or not, but what we're doing as a movement is creating this infectious idea that that the human soul and how the human soul has in fact developed over history, as Jerry went through in depth, real history, how this thing has developed. We're creating in-depth authority of the sense that this is, that not only do I know that something's true, but my senses, this is why the issue of music is so important, my senses are in fact organized around realizing that you have a dialogue of ideas which defines the pathway of human history. And this is important for history, as I was talking earlier, because the question of whether or not a nation's going to be defined by creativity, people say, well, you can't do that. How can you say something, how can you define something by creativity? It's like people told Kepler, how can you say this planet moves based on an intention? That's not a real cause. Where's the sense perceptible rule? Where's the epicycles? Well, I would say Hamilton did create the nation. That's why I think it's a striking example for people to realize today. He did found the country, and in fact, the country was founded on that you're only going to be able to continually educate popular opinion. You will only be able to maintain a nation if you had a constant deliberation and discussion, which was the big fear at the time, that you were going to have, you know, a nation that was going to be the tyranny over the states. And this is not an isolated discussion history, because we're at a point right now where all the states are bankrupt. They've lost the conception of the nation as a whole. We're dealing with the same problem of being dependent on private banks. And so we've lost these understandings. So, I mean, we don't have everything, we don't have all our time to discuss today, but the question of what the principles Hamilton found himself in, the situation he found himself in to develop then all the organizational financial measures, that's known, that's actually true. He did it. The problem that's missing right now is that we have to rediscover what the power, what the conception of the nation is, if we're going to be able to apply those things that are in fact, were in fact, and still are, the basis of any sound development of an economy.
Well, and that comes from the question of qualified leadership, which is just what you and Mihwa have been discussing. But let me bring Jerry back in, because Jerry, you have a concept which I find quite interesting, where you talk about big history. And I always assume when you talk about big history, you're talking about this kind of moment Lynn just characterized as a brief moment of opportunity, the point at which the crisis is almost overwhelming. You've almost come to the end, and the question is, can there be an impetus to make the change? How do you see this at present? Because we're talking about the potential to finish off this Anglo-Dutch Empire, and yet we have some slender reeds when you look at the Congress, mm-hmm. you look at the leaderships outside of the limb and outside of Lynn. How do you see this thing changing at this point?
Well, you know, it's funny, because what Michael and Mihwa have been really stressing is this question of dynamics. In other words, you can't understand a human being by trying to add up all attributes, right? Or even how a human being will function. Because sometimes human beings in the boomer generation, more often than not, will act on a set of principles which are destructive and will destroy the person. But at a certain point of crisis, when nothing is working, the quality of the human soul, which both Miwa and Michael are referring to, can become the dominant force in history. Now, how do you define this very interesting thing, which is one of the big anomalies in the situation? President Putin spoke to HW, who's no great shakes, right? Wasn't when he was president. He's not now. Okay. And they set up a group, which includes Primakov, who is very well known to us. He's a very decent guy, a real Russian nationalist in the best sense of what we mean by nation state. In fact, he was so hot, they had to destabilize him. Al Gore did that, you know, with the Balkans. Mm-hmm. But the point is, Primakov is working with Henry Kissinger, right? Now, Kissinger, we know, he is, you know, if he's not Satan,
so
it's only because Dick Cheney took the job. But anyway, the point is, he's not. I mean, what can I say about Kissinger? What haven't we said about Kissinger? Yeah. In fact, right? Okay, now you could freak out and say, but they don't control the dynamic.
That's right.
Their system is finished. Ambrose Evans Pritchard freaks out every day about $2 trillion in real estate assets, which are totally bankrupt. $2 trillion. Right? And he freaks out every day. Right? Now, Ambrose Evans Pritchard is no friend of ours. So therefore, as I joked 2 days ago when I was briefing everybody, I said, if these guys were sane, if they were rational, they would say, look, LaRouche is right. Our system is finished. We're going to have to go through a bankruptcy reorganization, but we're going to get LaRouche in a generation or two. Right? In other words, let's bite the bullet now. Right? And let's just back off. Let this happen. We'll still have money. We'll still run companies. We'll still have this. Right? But we will have to lose our power for a brief period of time. Right? That's what they would say. But as Lynn said, very much reminiscent of Louis the 15th, right, who said, après moi le déluge, right, which led to the French Revolution by Venetian manipulation, right, they said, we can't back off because we have to keep our power. Therefore, we're going to have to blow up the bubble even more and do more crazy things, right? But a number of people watching this thing, including Ambrose Evans Pritchard and factions in Britain, are saying, my God, we're over the cliff here, guys. We got to step back. So you're looking at a dynamic process in which Lynn's heavy ideas are the only ideas that will solve the crisis. And whether they like it or not, several people are saying, okay, we're going to have to do something different. And that, when they say that, the dynamic, as we saw in Kennebunkport, is a totally different dynamic. Once, as Michael will tell you and as Miwa will tell you, once you start an infinitesimal change, it defines the curvature of where you're going to end up. And that's what you're looking at this point.
I'd like to just ask both Michael and Miwa to comment on that from the standpoint of two young people who, when you first came into the movement, first came around LaRouche, there were ideas you liked, there were thoughts you had, you may have liked the music, the science, the politics, the sense of a difference. But what Jerry just described is really sort of an overwhelming change in identity, where suddenly you do realize that when Lynn says the future's in your hands, he really means it. And I'd just like to get from you your sense of how you've taken up this idea of personal responsibility. I mean, it's really hitting you now, isn't it?
Yeah, it definitely is. And Lynn helps. Having Lynn as an example, as an individual that's been consistently, you know, has developed an identity around this question, really helps our generation actually fight through it. But just that question in general, I think it's kind of funny that Jerry brings up the question of dynamics, is because this development of passion, of course, when you first, I don't know about Michael, but when you first meet the movement, obviously you don't know the ins and outs of all of the ideas, but obviously there is something that, like Michael was saying, like calls to your soul, that is something good that appeals to that quality of yourself that is human. And because you have this quote-unquote feeling, you can go with it, you can commit to it, because there's just a spark of interest, that spark of divinity or whatever it's called. But there is a spark that you can move with, that continues, if you continue to commit to the work, it continues to feed the passion. And you develop more and more of a passion to do it, which, you know, really solidifies the idea of commitment and that idea of identity.
And Michael, the work you're doing, I know, is long hours, tough work, translations, all sorts of things, but it's giving you a better sense of how you really do live in current history, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think the issue is you can't be stopped if you're worrying about being immortal. And if you're, because the issue is what time do you want to live in? Do you want to, I mean, you've got people, you've got the eyes of history upon you, generations of people, and you study history. You look at, say, how the nation was won. You've got a few people, Cotton Mather, a couple people, who kept the movement going, and they were gone. And you have a couple more people like Alexander Spotswood, and everything depended on a few people that moved this entire thing forward. You look at Carl Gauss. Given the conditions that he was in, you have no progress going on in science except in a couple people at each point in history, and that's how it's defined. And now, I mean, if you look at this last webcast on the 21st by LaRouche, the way he started off was really striking to me, because he said, people keep asking, when's the system going to collapse? And then he is this issue of, well, what determines it? It's the question of free will. And it struck me, because right away I said, aha, Lynn is standing up here talking about the question of the collapse of the system. And as he knows this thing is not going to be defined by some mechanical cause, because he's changing history as he's acting. You don't sit back and study history and say, how does this thing work? Because you define it. So why would you want to, why would you want to do anything else? That's the question. But it occurs to you, it strikes you when you really consider the fact that everybody has a finite time to make a contribution to the development of the human species. And we're at a point where we're not sitting back studying some fossils of history. And, you know, we're in the basement, the cellar of the history of ideas, polishing them off one by one and setting them up on a shelf for people to look at. But in fact, are you going to act on history, transform history, redefine, as Lynn went through in the last webcast, Riemann redefining all the ideas of CUSA, Kepler, Leibniz, etc.?
Michael, we're almost out of time, but that's exactly where we should end, this idea that what we've gone through in looking at the Anglo-Dutch Empire, its emergence as a power, its destructive operations, and now the possibility of ending it. This is a call to people out there to join with us now get the call in and get a copy of LaRouche's webcast at 800-929-7566. Jerry, Mihua, and Michael, thank you very much for joining us today. This
thank
has
you.
Been the LaRouche Show, and join
thank
us
you.
Again next Saturday.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.